Yes, Carr said. Okay. Then the so-called confrontation occurred when Ken Chastain offered a half-assed apology for totally fucking me over in my harassment complaint 2 years before. Put that in your report. He said he was sorry? For what? For not doing the right thing. He didn't back me, and he knew he should have. So here we are 2 years later, and I'm out of RHD and working the late show in Hollywood, and he apologizes. Let's just say the apology wasn't accepted. So this was just an aside. Nothing to do with the witness or the dancer's investigation. I told you that at the beginning. Ballard leaned back as the waitress brought her iced tea and Carr's tacos. She then squeezed the lemon into her glass as he began to eat. You want one of these? Carr offered. I told you, I'm not hungry, Ballard said. His starting to eat gave her time to think. She realized that she had dropped her own agenda for the conversation. She had been put on the defensive, largely through her own anger, and had lost sight of what she needed to accomplish with this interview. That is, get more information than she gave up. She suspected that Carr had pushed things in this direction purposely, knocking her off stride at the top of the interview, with questions even he knew weren't germane, and made her vulnerable to the questions that were. She looked at Carr crunching down in a taco and knew she had to be extra cautious now. So, Carr said, his mouth full of food, why'd you call Matthew Robison? There it was. Now Carr was getting down to business. Ballard realized that he was here to deliver a message. How do you know I called Matthew Robison? She asked. We've got a task force of 8 investigators and 2 supervisors on this, Carr said. I don't know how every piece of intelligence or evidence is procured. All I know is that you called him last night, several times, and I want to know why. If you don't want to answer, then maybe we will book that room over at Pacific Division and have a sit down there. He dropped a half-eaten taco to his plate. Things had suddenly gotten very serious. I called Robison to check on him, Ballard said. I felt responsible. I gave Spates to Chastain, and Spates gave him Robison. Now Chastain is dead. I went to Kenny's house. They wouldn't let me get close, but I picked up some intel that the last thing they knew about Kenny was that he was out Friday night trying to wrangle a witness. I know what wrangle a witness means, and I thought about Robison. I figured he was the guy Chastain, was trying to wrangle. So I called and left messages, and he hasn't called me back. That's it. She had chosen her words very carefully, so as not to reveal her extracurricular activities, including hacking her dead former partner's computer files. For all she knew, Carr was taping her while she was taping him. She needed to make sure she said nothing that would bring internal affairs down on her. Carr used a napkin to wipe guacamole off the corner of his mouth and then looked at her. Are you homeless, Detective Ballard? He asked. What are you talking about? She asked indignantly. You list that place 2 hours up the freeway as your home on personnel records. And it's on your driver's license, too. But I don't think you're there that much. That lady up there didn't seem to know when you were coming back. That lady doesn't give up information to strangers, badge or no badge. Look, I work the late show. My day begins when your day ends. What's it matter where I sleep or when I sleep? I do my job. The department requires me to have a permanent residence, and I have one. And it's not 2 hours up the coast when I drive it. Do you have any real questions? Yes, I do. Carr picked up his plate and handed it to a busboy who was walking by their table. Okay, he said. For the record, let's go over your activities Friday night. You want my alibi now? She asked. If you have one. But like I said at the top, you are not a suspect, Detective Ballard. We have the trajectory of the shot that killed Chastain. You would have had to be standing on a step stool to make the shot. And do you have time of death yet? Between 11 and 1. That's easy. I was on shift. I went to roll call at 11, then I went to work. You leave the station? Ballard tried to remember her movements. So much had happened in the past 72 hours that it was hard to recall what happened when. But once she had a beat on things, it all fell into place. Yes, I left, she said. Right after roll call, I left and went to Hollywood Presbyterian to check on a victim from an attempted murder I was working. I took photos, and a nurse over there named Natasha helped me. Sorry, I didn't get her last name. I never thought I'd need to confirm an alibi. That's okay, Carr said. When did you clear the hospital? A little after midnight. I then went to look for my victim's crib. I had an address on Heliotrope, and it turned out to be a homeless camp. She lived in an RV there, but somebody had taken it over and was squatting at it. So I called for backup, so I could take a look around inside. Officers Herrera and Dyson got the call. Okay, and after that? I returned to the station by 1:30. I remember driving by the dancers and seeing the crime scene van still out there. So when I got back, I went into the watch office to see what the lieutenant knew about it. I remember seeing the clock in there, and it was 1:30. Carr nodded. And you were tucked in for the rest of the night? He asked. Hardly, Ballard said. I got a line from a credit card security office in India on a motel room being used as a drop for stolen credit card purchases. I went over there and busted a guy. This time it was officers Taylor and Smith backing me up, and then the suspect's parole agent came in as well. His name is Compton, if you need it. Inventorying all the shit in the motel room and booking the suspect carried me through to dawn and end of shift. Great, and all easily checked. Yeah, for someone who isn't even a suspect. I'm glad I wasn't home sleeping all night. I'd be in big trouble. Listen, detective, I know you're all pissed off, but this had to be done. If we end up taking a guy down for Chastain, the first thing his lawyer will look at is whether we ran a full field investigation and checked out other possibles. You and Chastain had a falling out. A good defense lawyer could make hay with that at trial, and all I'm doing here is getting us into a position to head that off. I'm not the bad guy. I'm helping to make sure that we get a guilty verdict on whoever did this. His explanation seemed plausible on the surface, but Ballard couldn't buy in. She had to remember he was part of an investigation headed up by Lieutenant Olivas, a man who wouldn't mind her being completely banished from the department. Oh, good to know, she said. Thanks for the sarcasm, Carr said. And for what it's worth, I think you got royally screwed on your beef with Olivas. I know it. Everybody knows it. Just like everybody knows he's the kind of guy who would do what you said he did. He did the surrendering hands thing again. Now, would I say that if I was a bad guy? He said. Especially when I know you're recording every word I say. He nodded toward her phone on the table. Ballard picked up her phone, opened the screen, and closed the recording. She shoved the phone halfway into one of the back pockets of her jeans. Happy now? She asked. I don't care if you recorded me or not, he said. She looked at him a moment. What's your story, Carr? She asked. He shrugged. No story, he said. I'm a cop. And funny, but I don't like it when cops get murdered. I want to contribute, but they put me off on you. And I know it's bullshit, but it's my part in this, so I'm going to do my part. They? Olivas and my lieutenant. Other than spinning their wheels with me, do they have anything at all to go on? Near as I can tell, nothing. They don't know who the fuck they're looking for. Ballard nodded and thought about how much she could or should trust Carr. What he said about her complaint against Olivas went a long way with her, but she knew he had either been shut out of some of the case information or was holding back. If it was the former, that would be par for the course. Task force investigations were often compartmentalized. If it was the latter, then she was talking to a man she couldn't trust. She decided to move forward and see how he reacted. Has there been any mention of the possibility of it being a cop? She asked. In the booth and with Chastain? Seriously? Carr asked. No, nothing. Not that I've heard. But I arrived late to the party, and there is a clear separation between the homicide special guys and us major crimes folk. We're riding in coach on this. Ballard nodded. Why? What have you got? Carr asked. The burn on Fabian's chest, Ballard said. There was a theory that he was wearing a wire. What, for internal affairs? He asked. For himself. He was looking at 5 years in the federal pen unless he could come up with something to trade. And you know this how? Ballard had a problem here. She didn't want to give up Towson, but they were going to come to him anyway, because one of Chastain's last calls had been to the defense attorney. If they came to him and he mentioned Ballard's visit, then she would face the wrath of Lieutenant Olivas. You have to protect me on this, she said. What I know will help you. Shit, Ballard, I don't know, Carr said. Don't put me in the middle of something where I get jammed up. You said you're retracing Chastain's steps, right? Me and others, yeah. Well, somebody drew Fabian's lawyer. Chastain talked to him Friday. Call whoever drew the assignment and say you'll take it. Well, first of all, I already drew that assignment. Dean Towson is on my to-do list. But more importantly, how do you know Chastain talked to him? And how do you know about any of this stuff? The burn on the chest, the wire, the lawyer? What have you been doing, Ballard? I was at the crime scene Thursday night. I was there when they found the burn. When Chastain got killed, I made a couple calls. He was my partner and taught me a lot. I owed it to him. Carr shook his head, not seeing the validity of her moves. Look, he said, I'm working the Chastain side of this. I don't know anything about a burn mark or a wire. But even if Fabian was wired, it doesn't mean he was taping a cop. He could have been taping one of the other mutts in the booth. They were all criminals. Ballard shrugged. They weren't high enough value for the feds, she said. Talk to Towson. It was a cop. Carr frowned. Ballard pushed on. Speaking of the other mutts in the booth, how do they connect them? She asked. I'm not sure, Carr said. I'm on Chastain. They weren't strangers. They were all in pitches together. 5 years ago. Same month. That doesn't mean anything. Pitches is a big place. If someone looked into it, I think they'd find they were in the same dorm. That cuts it down to size. Carr stared at her eye to eye. Ballard, really? What the fuck have you been doing? My job. I get a lot of downtime on the late show. And I guess you could say I'm like you. Nobody should put a cop down and walk away from it. I had my problems with Kenny, but he was my partner for almost 5 years, and he was a closer. I learned a lot with him. But look, I'm outside the case. You're in. I can feed you whatever I get. You just have to protect me on it. I don't know. If they find out you're sniffing around on it, then it comes back to me. I think you just need to steer clear, Ballard. I'll go with what you just gave me, but you need to stand down. That's the message I was supposed to deliver. Ballard stood up. Fine. Whatever. Message received. I've got other cases to work. Look, don't go off mad. She stepped away from the table and went through the opening in the railing. She came back around to unhook the dog's leash. She looked at Carr one more time. You need me? You know where to find me. Sure. She walked off with her dog. It was almost dark now on the beach, and the wind off the water was getting cold. Chapter 21 Ballard's first stop was at the Critter Sitters off Abbot Kinney. Sarah was reluctant to take the dog in, even though she was paid extra when Lola spent more than the night at her home. She's getting depressed, she said. She misses you all the time. Sarah was a longtime resident of Venice who sold sunglasses on the boardwalk. She had offered to help when Ballard rescued Lola from her homeless and abusive owner. That had amounted to a place to stay while Ballard worked the midnight shift. But the schedule had gone out the window in recent days. I know, Ballard said. It's not fair, but I keep thinking that things will return to normal soon. I just got a bunch of cases all at once. If it keeps up, maybe you should take her up to your grandmother's to stay, Sarah suggested. So she has some continuity with someone? That's a good idea, Ballard said. But I hope soon it will all slow down and go back to normal. Ballard drove east toward Hollywood, trying to bury her frustrations from the conversations with both Sarah and Carr. With Carr, she was particularly stressed because she put herself on the line with her revelations and had not gotten a clear signal from him that he would push forward on the case in return. His final message was to stand down, but she didn't know if it was because he was going to take it from there or if nothing would happen at all. At the station, she put the Chastain investigation aside for the time being and went back to work on the Ramona Ramone case. Her first move was to call Hollywood Presbyterian to check on the victim's medical status. After a runaround that included several minutes of being on hold, she started to worry that Ramon had taken a bad turn and succumbed to her injuries. But finally, Ballard was talking to an evening supervisor who reported that earlier in the day the patient had been transferred to the Los Angeles County USC Medical Center in downtown. Ballard asked if the transfer meant that Ramona had come out of the coma, but the supervisor refused to share details of her medical condition, citing privacy laws. Nevertheless, Ballard knew that there were laws regulating patient dumping, and she didn't think that moving a patient in a coma was allowed. This gave her hope that Ramona Ramone might finally be able to take part in the investigation. Ballard decided that she would go down to County USC to check on Ramone's medical status, security, and availability as a witness as soon as possible. But for the moment, her focus was still squarely on Thomas Trent, and it was time to get back on the case and keep pushing. Ballard still wanted to talk to Trent's ex-wife. Her ending the marriage following his arrest and her apparent decision not to fight for a share of the house in the hills indicated that this was a woman who just wanted to get away from a bad guy and a bad mistake. Ballard thought his ex-wife might talk about Trent without turning around and tipping him off to the police's interest in him. There were other precautions that could be taken to guard against this, but overall Ballard felt confident in her decision to go directly to the ex, Mrs. Trent. Tracing Beatrice Trent on the DMV database, Ballard was able to follow her through three addresses and a name change since the divorce. She was now Beatrice Beaupré, and by going back in time with the search, Ballard learned that that was her name when she received her first California driver's license 2 decades earlier. She was now 44 years old and currently listed on DMV records as living in Canoga Park. Before leaving the station, she put together a six-pack of mugshots that included the photo taken of Thomas Trent after his arrest for the brass knuckles. She hoped that before the night was through, she would be showing the lineup to Ramona Ramon. Sunday evening traffic was a breeze, and Ballard got to Canoga Park before 9. It was late to be calling on the unsuspecting Beatrice Beaupré, but not that late. Whether at 9 in the morning or evening, Ballard always liked to employ the cold call at the odd hour. It put people back on their heels a bit, made them easier to talk to. But it was Ballard who was knocked back on her heels when she got to the address on Owens Mouth Avenue, listed with the DMV as Beaupré's home address. She was in the middle of a deserted warehouse district where small businesses and manufacturers operated by day but shut down tight at night. She pulled to a stop in front of an aluminum-sided building with a door that was marked only with an address number. There were 5 other cars and a van parked near the door, and a flashing red strobe located above it. Ballard knew enough about the valley's most prosperous industries to figure out that inside the warehouse there was a porno shoot underway. The flashing light meant do not enter until the scene was completed. Ballard sat in her car and watched the strobe. It stayed on for the next 12 minutes, and she wondered if that meant people inside were having sex for that long. As soon as it went off, she got out and reached the door before it started flashing again. The handle was locked and she knocked. She was ready with her badge when the door opened, and a man wearing a wool beanie looked out. "What's up?" he said. "You checking condoms?" "No, I don't care about condoms," Ballard said. "I need to talk to Beatrice Beaupré. Can you get her, please?" He shook his head. "Nobody named that here," he said. He started to pull the door closed, but Ballard grabbed it and recited the description she remembered from Beaupré's DMV records. Black female, 5'10", 44 years old. She might not be using the name Beatrice. "That sort of sounds like Sadie. Hold on." This time, Ballard let him close the door. She clipped her badge to her belt and turned her back to the door as she waited. She noticed that 2 of the warehouses across the street had no outside signage either. One of them had a strobe light over the door as well. Ballard was at ground zero for the billion-dollar-plus industry that some said kept the Los Angeles economy rolling. The door finally opened and a woman fitting the description in the DMV records stood there. She wore no makeup. Her hair was pulled back in a haphazard knot, and she wore a t-shirt and baggy workout pants. She was not what Ballard expected a porn star to look like. "What can I do for you, officer?" "It's Detective. Are you Beatrice Beaupré?" "I am, and I'm working. You need to state your business or be gone." "I need to talk to you about Thomas Trent." That hit Beaupré like a swinging door. "I don't know anything about him anymore," she said, "and I gotta go." She started backing inside and pulling the door closed. Ballard knew that she had one shot and that it might risk the whole investigation if she took it. "I think he hurt someone," she said. "Badly." Beaupré paused, her hand on the knob. "And he'll do it again," Ballard said. That said it all. Ballard waited. "Fuck," Beaupré finally said. "Come in." Ballard followed her into a dimly lit entry with hallways that went right and left. A sign with an arrow said the stages were to the left and offices and craft services to the right. They went right and along the way past the man who had originally opened the door to Ballard. "Billy, tell him we're taking a 15-minute break," Beaupré said. "And I mean 15. Don't let anybody leave the stage. In 10 minutes, start Danielle fluffing. We shoot as soon as I get back." They passed an alcove set up with a kitchen counter covered with baskets of snacks and candy bars as well as a coffee maker. A long cooler was open on the floor and filled with water bottles and cans of soda. They went into an office with the name Shady Sadie on the door. The walls were lined with posters from adult film features that showed nearly nude performers in provocative poses. It looked to Ballard from the titles, costumes, what little there was of them, and poses that the video slanted toward bondage and sadomasochistic fetishes. A lot of female domination. "Have a seat," Beaupré said. "I can give you 15 minutes and then I have to shoot. Otherwise it will be like herding cats out there." Beaupre sat behind a desk and Ballard took the chair opposite her. "You're the director?" Ballard asked. "Director, writer, producer, cinematographer. You name it," Beaupre said. "I'd do the whipping and fucking too, but I'm too old." "Who did Thomas hurt?" "At the moment, he's a person of interest. The victim was a transgender prostitute that I believe was abducted, raped, and tortured over a 4-day period, and then left for dead." "Fuck. I knew he would do it one day." "Do what?" "Act out his fantasies. That's why I left him. I didn't want him acting them out on me." "Miss Beaupre, before we go on, I need you to promise that what we talk about here will be kept confidential, especially from him." "Are you kidding? I don't talk to that man. He's the last person on earth I would talk to." Ballard studied her for signs of deception. She saw nothing that dissuaded her from proceeding. She just wasn't sure where to start. She pulled out her phone. "Do you mind if I record this?" she asked. "Yes, I do," Beaupre said. "I don't want to be involved in this, and I don't want a recording floating around out there that he might one day hear." Ballard put the phone away. She had expected Beaupre's response. She proceeded without recording. "I'm trying to get a bead on your ex-husband," she began. "What kind of guy he is? What would make him do something like this crime, if he did it?" "He's fucked up," Beaupre said. "Simple as that. I make S&M videos. The action is fake. The pain is not real. A lot of the audience knows that, and a lot don't want to know that. They want it to be real. He's one of them." "Did you meet because he was interested in your videos?" "No, we met because I wanted to buy a car." "He was a salesman?" "That's right. I think he recognized me, but he always claimed he didn't." "From directing?" "No, I was still a performer back then. I think he'd seen me on video and came running across the showroom, you know, wanting to help put me into something sweet. He always denied it, but I think he'd seen my work." Ballard pointed a thumb toward the door. "Shady Sadie. That's your porno name?" "One of many. I've had a long line of names and looks. I sort of reboot every few years, like the audience does. Right now I'm Shady Sadie, the director. Let's see, I've been Ebony Knights, Shaquilla Shackles, BB Black, Stormy Monday, a few others. What, you seen me?" She had noted Ballard's smile. "No, it's just a weird coincidence," Ballard said. "Two nights ago I met a man who called himself Stormy Monday." "In porn?" Beaupre asked. "No, something else entirely." "So you said Trent had fantasies?" "He was all fucked up. He was into pain. He wanted to give pain, see it in their eyes." "Their eyes? Who are we talking about?" "I'm talking about his fantasies. What he liked in my videos, what he wanted to do in real life." "You're saying he never acted out?" "Not with me. I don't know about with others, but he got arrested and he had metal knuckles on him. That was crossing the line." "That's why you left?" "That whole thing. Not only was he going there to hurt someone, but the police were saying it was a boy. When I heard that, I had to go. It was too fucked up, even for me." "What's your take on the psychology of this?" "What the fuck does that mean?" "My victim's Latina. With the brass knuckles thing, he was going to see a Latino male. His ex-wife is African-American but light-skinned. There's a victim type here, and I was no fucking victim." "Sorry, I misspoke. But he's got a type. It's part of what is called a paraphilia, part of a sexual program, for lack of a better word. It's part of the subjugation and control thing he has. In my films, I was the top, the dominatrix. In our marriage, he wanted to control me, keep me under his thumb like I was a challenge to him."
"But he wasn't abusive?"
"He wasn't. Not to me, at least, because I would have been out the door. But that doesn't mean he didn't use intimidation and his physical size to control things. You can use your size without being physically abusive."
"How much porno did he watch?"
"Look, don't go down that road. The whole porno made him do it thing. We provide a service. People watch these films and that keeps them in check, keeps it in fantasy."
Ballard was not sure Beaupre believed the words as she said them. Ballard could easily take the side that pornography was a gateway to aberrant behavior, but she knew now was not the time. She needed this woman as a source and eventually a potential witness. Calling her on her lifestyle and occupation was not the way to do it.
"I need to get back to the stage," Beaupre said abruptly. "There's no tomorrow on this. I lose one of my performers at midnight. She has school tomorrow."
Ballard spoke urgently. "Please, just a few more minutes," she said. "You lived with him in the house on Wrightwood Drive."
"Yes, he had that when I met him," Beaupre said,
I moved in. How'd he get a place like that selling cars?
He didn't get it selling cars.
He exaggerated his injuries from when he was in a helicopter crash coming back from Catalina. Got a hack doctor to back him on it and sued. He ended up getting like $800,000 and bought the upside down house.
Ballard leaned forward in her chair.
She wanted to proceed cautiously and not feed any answers to Beaupré.
You mean like it was in foreclosure? She asked.
They were upside down on their mortgage?
No, it was literally upside down, Beaupré said.
The bedrooms were downstairs instead of up. Tom always called it the upside down house.
Is that how he would describe it to others, to visitors, the upside down house?
Pretty much, yeah. He thought it was funny. He said it was an upside down house for an upside down world.
It was a key piece of information, and the fact that Beaupré had volunteered it made it all the more convincing.
Ballard kept moving.
Let's talk about the brass knuckles, she said.
What do you know about them?
I mean, I knew he had them, Beaupré said, but I didn't think he'd ever use them.
He had all kinds of weapons. Stick knives, throwing stars, metal knuckles. He called them metal knuckles because technically not all of them were brass.
So he had multiple pairs.
Oh yeah, he had a collection.
Did he have duplicates?
The pair that were seized during his arrest said good and evil on them.
Did he have another pair like that?
He had a bunch of them, and most said that.
That was his thing.
He said he would have had that tattooed on his knuckles, good and evil, except he'd probably lose his job.
Ballard knew it was a big get. Beatrice was giving her the building blocks of a case.
He kept his weapons in the house?
Yeah, in the house.
Guns?
No guns.
He didn't like guns for some reason. He said he liked weapons with edges.
What else is in the house?
I don't know. I haven't been there in a long time. I know this, though. He put all his money into buying the house because he said real estate was better than putting money in the bank. But that meant he didn't have much left over to furnish the place. A couple of those bedrooms were completely empty, at least when I lived there.
Ballard thought about the room she saw off the lower deck.
Beaupré stood up.
Look, we wrap at midnight, she said. You want to hang and watch or come back then? We can talk more. But I need to go. Time is money in this business.
Right, Ballard said.
Okay.
She decided to take a shot in the dark.
Did you keep a key? She asked.
What?
Beaupré said.
When you got divorced, did you keep a key to the house? A lot of people who go through a divorce keep a key.
Beaupré looked at Ballard with indignation.
I told you I wanted nothing to do with that man, back then or now. I didn't keep a key because I never wanted to go near that place again.
Okay. Because if you did, I might be able to use it, you know, in an emergency. The guy who did the damage to my victim, it wasn't the kind of thing he'll do only once. If he thinks he got away with it, he'll do it again.
That's too bad.
Beaupré stood next to the door to usher Ballard out. They moved down the hallway, and when they passed by the alcove where the snacks were, Ballard saw a woman who was naked except for thigh-high boots, pausing over a choice of candy bar.
Bella, we are shooting, Beaupré said. I'm going back now.
Bella didn't respond.
Beaupré led Ballard to the front door and ushered her out, offered her good luck with her investigation.
Ballard handed her a business card with the usual request to call if anything else came to mind.
The DMV lists this as your home address, Ballard said.
Is that true?
Isn't a home the place where you eat, fuck, and sleep?
Beaupré said.
Maybe.
So no other place?
I don't need another place, detective.
Beaupré closed the door.
Ballard started her car but then opened her notebook and started writing down as much as she could remember from the interview.
Head down and writing, she was startled by a sharp rap on the car window. She looked up to see Billy, the doorman in the beanie. She lowered the window.
Detective, Shady said you forgot this, he said.
He held out a key.
It was not on a ring. It was just a key.
Oh, Ballard said.
Right. Thank you.
She took the key and then put the window back up.
Chapter 22.
Ballard made her way to the 101 freeway and headed south toward downtown. She drove with internal momentum. She still didn't have a shred of direct evidence, but the interview with Beatrice Beaupré pushed Thomas Trent further across the line that separated person of interest and suspect. He was now Ballard's one and only focus, and her thoughts were exclusively on how to build a prosecutable case. She was just taking the curve into the Cahuenga Pass when her phone buzzed, and she saw it was Jenkins.
She connected her earbuds and took the call. Hey, partner, just checking in before heading in. I got any holdovers from you?
Jenkins was on shift by himself for the next two nights. It was supposed to be Ballard's weekend.
Not really, she said. Hopefully you'll have a quiet watch.
I wouldn't mind sitting in the bureau all night, Jenkins said.
Well, at least for the first hour or so, I have the car.
What? You're supposed to be up in Ventura surfing. What's going on?
I just came from an interview with the ex-wife of the suspect on the Ramona Ramon case.
It's him. No doubt. He's our guy. Calls his crib the upside-down house, just like the victim said to Taylor and Smith.
All right.
She could tell by his tone and the way that he drew out the words that he was not convinced.
He also collects sets of brass knuckles, she added, with good and evil on them. You can see the letters and the bruising on Ramona. I went back to check and take pictures.
Jenkins was silent at first. This was new information to him, and it was also an indication of her obsession with the case. Finally, he spoke.
You have enough for a search warrant?
I'm not there yet, but the victim was transferred to county, which I don't think they could do if she was still in the coma. So I'm headed there, and if she's awake, I'm going to have her look at a six-pack. If she makes the ID, then I'll bring the package to McAdams in the morning and come up with a plan.
There was only silence from Jenkins as he apparently dealt with having been left on the platform as the train sped by without stopping.
Okay, he finally said.
You want me to divert and meet you at county?
No, I think I've got it covered, Ballard said. You get in and take roll call, see what's going on. I'll let you know when I'm on my way back with the car.
County USC used to be a dire place, but in recent years it had gotten a facelift and a paint job, and was no longer as cheerless as it had once been. Its medical staff were no doubt as dedicated and skilled as the crew at any private hospital in the city, but like with most giant bureaucracies, everything always came down to budget. Ballard's first stop was at the security office, where she showed her badge and attempted to persuade a nighttime supervisor named Roosevelt to put extra eyes on Ramona Ramon. Roosevelt, a tall, thin man nearing retirement age, was more interested in whatever was on his computer screen than in what Ballard was selling.
No can do, he said bluntly. I put someone on that room, I gotta take him off the ER door. And no way those nurses down there will let me do that. They'd skin me alive if I left them unprotected like that.
You're telling me you got one guy in the ER and that's it? Ballard said.
No, I got two. One inside, one out. But 99% of our violence happens in the ER. So we have two-step protection. One guy on the walk-ins, another to handle those that come in the back of an ambulance. I can't lose either one. So meantime, my victim is up there naked. No protection at all. We have security in the elevator lobbies, and I float. If you want extra protection up in that room, then I would invite you to ask the LAPD to provide it.
That's not going to happen.
Then I'm sorry.
I got your name, Roosevelt. If anything happens, it'll go in the report.
Make sure you spell it right, just like the president.
Ballard next went up to the acute care ward, where Ramon was being treated. She was disappointed to learn that, while the patient had been conscious and semi-alert when transported from Hollywood Presbyterian, she had since been sedated and intubated after a setback in her condition. Choosing to find and interview Beaupre as the day's priority had cost Ballard a chance to communicate with her victim. She nevertheless visited Ramon and took cell phone photos as part of the continuing documentation of the depth of her injuries and treatment. She hoped someday to show them to a jury. Afterward, Ballard made a stop at the nursing desk on the ward and handed the duty nurse a stack of her business cards.
Can you pass these around and keep one there by your phone? She asked.
If anybody comes in to see the patient in 307, I need to know. If you get any calls inquiring about her status, I need to know. Take a name, number, and say you'll get back to them. Then tell me.
Is the patient in danger?
She was the subject of a vicious attack and left for dead. I checked with your security officer and got turned down on extra security. So all I'm saying is be vigilant.
Ballard left then, hoping that putting the word in the duty nurse's ear might get some results.
Hospital security would find it harder to resist internal safety concerns than those from the LAPD. Back at the station by midnight, Ballard was walking down the rear hallway toward the D Bureau as Jenkins came down the stairs from the roll call room. They walked into the Bureau side by side.
Anything going on? Ballard asked.
All quiet on the Western Front, Jenkins said.
He held up his hand as she put the City Ride's keys in his palm.
Ramona look at a six-pack? Jenkins asked.
Nope,
Ballard said. Missed my chance. I'm pissed at myself. I should have been there when she was awake. Don't beat yourself up. Brain injury like that? Chances are she's not going to remember a thing. And if she did, a defense attorney would go to town on the ID. Maybe. So you're going to go up the coast now? Not yet. I want to write up a summary on my witness from tonight. Man, you act like this place still pays overtime or something. I wish. Well, get it done and get out of here. I will. What about you? Monroe says I have to write up a report about the witness bust from the other night. Somebody filed a notice of intent to sue, said they suffered pain and humiliation because they were locked up in a jail bus. I have to say they were never locked up. You gotta be kidding me. I wish. They went off to their respective corners of the room. Ballard got right to work on a witness statement drawn from the interview with Beatrice Beaupré, putting special emphasis on the revelation that Thomas Trent often referred to his home as the Upside Down House. It would be ready to go into a charging package if Ramona Ramon ever ID'd Trent. 30 minutes later, she completed the report. She was also finished for the night, but then remembered she wanted to check the property report on the dancer's case. She went to her filing cabinet and looked through the thick ream of documents she had printed while going through Chastain's files. She located the preliminary evidence report and took it back to her desk. The evidence list was 7 pages long. It wasn't the official evidence report from forensics, but the ledger that an RHD detective would keep while at the crime scene. It served as a reference for the investigators on any evidence that had been collected while they awaited the official report. Ballard went through it twice, but saw nothing listed that resembled the small black button she had seen Chastain scoop into an evidence bag. She became convinced that her former partner had taken evidence from the scene without documenting it. It was something small, and something that sent him off the reservation, conducting his own investigation. An investigation that got him killed. Ballard sat there motionless as she ran the image of Chastain at the crime scene through her mind. Her attention was then drawn to the other side of the room, when she noticed Lieutenant Monroe enter the bureau from the front hallway and head toward where Jenkins was sitting. Ballard thought Monroe was probably going to send her partner out on a call. She grabbed the evidence report and got up to listen, in case it was a situation in which Jenkins would need a backup. She grabbed her rover as well and headed their way. Though the desks Jenkins and Ballard used were in diagonally opposite corners of the squad room, there wasn't a direct pathway between them. Ballard had to walk down an aisle along the front of the room and then down a second aisle to come up behind Monroe. As she approached, she saw an uncomfortable look on her partner's face as he looked up at the watch commander, and she realized that Monroe wasn't handing out an assignment. All I'm saying is, you're the lead. You call the shots. Put her on a leash, and... The rover in Ballard's hand started broadcasting a call. Monroe stopped and turned to see Ballard standing there. And what, LT? She said. Monroe's face momentarily showed his shock, and then he threw a glance back at Jenkins, registering his betrayal and not being warned of her approach. Look, Ballard, he said. So you want me on a leash? Ballard asked. Or are you just the messenger? Monroe held up both hands, as if trying to stop a physical rush from her. Ballard, listen to me. I didn't know you were here, he stammered. You're supposed to be off. I mean, if I knew you were here, I would have said the same thing to you as I said to Jenks. Which was what? She asked. Look, there are people who are afraid you're going to fuck things up, Ballard. Afraid you're going to cross a line on this Chastain thing. It's not your case, and you need to stand the fuck down. What people, LT? Olivas? Is he worried about me or himself? Look, I'm not naming names. I'm just, you're naming me. You just went to my partner and said, put Ballard on a leash. Like you just said, I'm only the messenger here, detective, and the message is delivered. That's it. He turned and headed toward the rear hallway, taking the long way to the watch office rather than having to pass by Ballard. Ballard looked at Jenkins when they were alone. Asshole, she said. Fucking coward, Jenkins said. Took the long way back. What would you have said to him if I hadn't walked up? I don't know. Maybe I would have said, you got something to say to Ballard, tell her yourself. Maybe I would have said fuck off. I hope so, partner. So what exactly have you been doing that's got their balls twisted? That's the thing, I'm not sure. But that's the second so-called message I've gotten today. Some guy from Majors went up to Ventura and then down to the beach to find me and tell me the same thing. And I don't even know what I did. Jenkins scrunched his face up in suspicion and worry. He wasn't buying that she didn't know what she had done. He was worried she would keep doing it. "Watch yourself, kid. These people don't fuck around. I already know that." He nodded. Ballard stepped up to his desk and put down the rover for him to use. "I think I'm going to go up to the suite," she said. "Come get me if you need me. Otherwise, I'll probably catch you before you leave." "Don't bother," Jenkins said. "Sleep late if you can. You need it. Just pisses me off that he comes in here to you because he thinks I'm out. Look, I've been reading about Japan to Marcy, and they have this saying over there. I'm talking about these men and you're telling me about Japan? Would you listen to me? I'm not one of these men, okay? I read her books about places we never got to. She's interested in Japanese history right now, so that's what I'm reading to her. And there's a saying that they have about conformist society. The nail that sticks out gets pounded down. Okay, so what are you saying? I'm saying there's a lot of guys in this department with hammers. Watch yourself. You don't have to tell me that. I don't know. Sometimes I think I do. Whatever. I'm going. I'm suddenly so tired of all of this. Get some sleep. Jenkins solemnly held up a fist, and Ballard bumped it with her own. It was a way of saying they were okay. Ballard put the evidence report back in her file drawer and locked it, then left the bureau. She went up the stairs in the back hall to the station's second floor, where across the hall from the roll call room, there was a room known as the honeymoon suite. It was a bunk room with three-tier bunks running along opposite walls. It was first come, first served, and on a counter at one end of the room were stacks of plastic wrap bunk packs, two sheets, a pillow, and a thin jail blanket. The slide sign on the door was moved to occupied. Ballard took out her phone, turned on the light, and quietly opened the door and moved into the room. The switch for the overhead lights was taped into the off position, so that nobody blasted sleepers. Ballard used her phone to check the bunks and saw that two middle beds were taken by sleepers, one of whom was lightly snoring. She took off her shoes and put them in a cubbyhole, then grabbed two sleep packs and tossed them up onto one of the top bunks. She climbed the ladder and flipped the thin mattress over before crawling into the sleeping space. It took her 5 minutes to spread the sheets and get under the blanket. Clasping the two pillows around her head to ward off the sound of snoring, she tried to go to sleep. As she tailed off into darkness, she thought about the two warnings to stand down that she had gotten during the day. She knew she had somehow triggered them with her actions the day before. She reviewed her steps, trying to remember every detail of every move she had made, and still could not locate the landmine she had apparently stepped on. Fighting sleep, she backed things up further into Friday night, and then moved forward again, using her memory like a battering ram. This time she hit on something that had not stuck out before, because it had not gotten her anywhere. After reviewing Chastain's chrono, she had tried to contact Matthew Metro Robeson to see if he was the witness Chastain had been out wrangling on Friday night before he was killed. She had never reached Robeson, but had left at least three messages on his phone. Robeson was missing, and the task force was looking for him. When Carr came to question her on the beach, he knew that she had called him. What troubled Ballard now was that if Robeson, wherever he was, had his cell phone with him, which he most likely did, how did Carr and the task force know that she had been calling him through the night? She remembered asking Carr that question, but he hadn't answered her. He had passed it off and said he had simply been given the information. It was something that didn't make sense. It gnawed at her until she finally slipped into sleep. Chapter 23. A loud round of raucous laughter from the roll call room penetrated the honeymoon suite and woke Ballard. She felt disoriented and almost banged her head on the ceiling as she started to get up. She pulled her phone and checked the time. She was shocked to learn that she had slept until 10 a.m. and knew she would have gone longer if not for the mid-watch roll call being conducted across the hall. She balled up her sheets, blankets, and pillows and carefully climbed down from the top bunk. She noticed she was the only one left in the room. Dumping everything in the hamper, she put on her shoes and made her way down the hall to the woman's locker room. Under the hot shower, she came to fully and tried to recall the events of the night before. She remembered that she had fallen asleep with a question. How did Roger's car know that she had been calling the missing Matthew Robeson? Today was Monday, a day off, but she resolved to know the answer to that question before the day was through. After dressing in fresh clothes from her locker, Ballard sat on a bench and composed a text to Carr. Need to talk. Are you around? She hesitated for a moment and then sent it. She knew that Carr might share it with others and discuss how to proceed, but she was banking on him not doing that. She knew a quick response to her text would indicate he had not shared it with anyone yet. He replied, "In person? Where? Not the PAB." She thought about things and returned the text, setting up the meeting. Her choice for a location was the 14th floor of the Criminal Courts building, because it would be a perfectly natural place for police detectives to be seen. If anybody at Major Crimes or the PAB asked Carr where he was going, he could just say the courthouse, and it would not raise a question. The location would also put Ballard in close proximity to the county USC Medical Center, where she hoped to find Ramona Ramone conscious and alert later in the day. Before leaving the station, she knocked on Lieutenant McAdams' door in the detective bureau and updated him on the Ramona Ramone investigation. He was reserved about Trent's collection of brass knuckles and use of the phrase upside-down house to describe his home. McAdams cautioned that the evidence was circumstantial and reminded her that the basis of Ballard's excitement was an ex-wife's claims. "You're gonna need more than that," McAdams said. "I know," said Ballard. "I'll get it." After checking out the late shift plan rep, Ballard headed downtown on the 101 freeway. Battling the traffic, going into downtown, finding parking, and then waiting for the elevator in the courthouse made her 20 minutes late for her meeting with Carr. But she found the detective from Major Crimes sitting on a bench outside a courtroom door, checking messages on his phone. She slid onto the wooden bench next to him. "Sorry I'm late. Everything went wrong. Traffic, parking, had to wait 10 minutes for a fucking elevator." "You could have texted, but never mind that. What's this about, Ballard?" "Okay, yesterday. I asked you a question, and you never answered it. We got distracted or you moved on, but I never got a full answer." "What question?" "You asked me why I had called Matthew Robison, and I asked you how you knew that I had." "I did answer that. I told you I was given the information that you were trying to reach him." "I don't deny it. But who told you that I'd been calling him?" "I don't get it. Why does this matter?" "Think about it. Robison is missing, right?" Carr didn't answer right away. He seemed to be very carefully weighing what information to share with her. "We're looking for him, yeah," he finally said. "I assume that wherever he's at, if he's alive, he's got his cell phone with him, right?" she asked quickly. "Or was it recovered at his home or elsewhere?" "Not as far as I know." "Then if he's out there in hiding, he has his phone. If he's dead, then whoever killed him has his phone. Either way, how is it known that I called him? Are you going to tell me they pulled his call records that quick? I've never turned a phone company warrant around in less than a day before, let alone a Saturday when nobody's working. On top of that, he's a witness, not a suspect. There's no probable cause for a warrant to pull his records in the first place." Carr didn't respond. "I guess the alternative is that they have my records or a tap on my phone. But that doesn't make sense unless you lied to me yesterday and I actually am a primary suspect. If that's the case, you wouldn't have let me tape our conversation. And you wouldn't have talked to me, period, without Mirandizing me." "You're not a suspect, Ballard. I told you that." "Okay. Then it comes back to my question. How does anyone know I was calling Robison?" Carr shook his head in frustration. "Look, I don't know. Maybe it was a welfare warrant. He's gone, and they got a warrant to pull his records because they're worried he might be in trouble or something." "I already thought about that, but it doesn't work," Ballard said. "If they wanted to find him to see if he was okay, they would have pinged his phone to find his location and check on him. There's something else. Somebody knows I called him." "Who told you?" "Listen to me. All I know is that my lieutenant came out of the meeting and told me you had been calling Robison, and I needed to find out why and shut you down. That's it."
"Who's your lieutenant?"
"Blackwelder." "Okay. What meeting was Blackwelder in?"
"What?"
"You just said he came out of a meeting and gave you instructions about me. Don't play dumb. What meeting?"
"He was in the meeting with Olivas and a couple other RHD guys. Major Crimes got called in after Chastain got hit, and it was the meeting where Olivas brought Blackwelder up to speed. So Olivas is the source. Somehow he knew I had been calling Robison."
Carr looked around the busy hallway to make sure no one was overtly watching them. People were going by in all directions, but none seemed to be interested in the two detectives.
"Maybe," he said, "he wasn't the only guy in the room."
More than maybe, Ballard said. Think about it. How did Olivas know that I was calling Robison if he didn't have his phone? Ballard waited, but Carr said nothing. Something doesn't add up, she said. This is part of your cop theory, isn't it? Carr finally said. You want to put this on a cop?
I want to put it on the person responsible. That's it.
Well, then, what's the next move here?
I don't know, but I think you need to proceed with caution.
Listen, Ballard, I get it. Olivas fucked you over big time. But suggesting without a shred of evidence that he knows about this or has information about, that's not what I'm doing.
Seems like it to me.
Frustrated, Ballard looked around the hallway while she decided what to do.
I have to go, she finally said.
Where? Carr asked. You still need to steer clear of this, Ballard.
I have my own case to work, so don't worry.
She stood up and looked down at Carr.
Don't look at me like that, he said. You have zero evidence of anything. You have a theory. But even if you are right about it being a cop, trying to put it on the guy everyone knows is your antagonist in the department doesn't sell, Ballard.
At least not yet, Ballard said.
She started to walk off.
Ballard, would you come back here? Carr said. She turned around and looked down at him again.
Why? She said.
You're not going to do anything, and I got a case that I need to work.
Just sit down a minute, will you? Carr pleaded.
She reluctantly sat.
You did this yesterday, Carr said.
I have a case to work. Goodbye.
What's so important about this other case?
There's a guy out there hurting people because he likes it, Ballard said. He's big evil, and I'm going to stop him.
Thomas Trent?
How the fuck do you know that?
But then she shook her head.
She didn't need the answer, though Carr gave it.
You know that every access to NCIC is logged, he said. I saw that you ran down the three stiffs in the booth in this Thomas Trent. I was wondering who this guy was and what the connection was.
Now you know, Ballard said.
No connection.
You people. That case has nothing to do with Chastain or the dancers or anything else.
Good to know.
Look, are you going to do anything with what I just gave you or not?
I will, Ballard. But think about what you're suggesting. A police lieutenant kills five people in a bar, then takes out one of his own people?
For what?
Because he's got what? Gambling debts? It's a big fucking stretch.
There's no explanation for why people kill. You know that. And if you cross that line, what's to stop you from going from 1 to 6?
She looked off and down the hallway. In that moment, she saw a man avert his eyes from her. He was across the hall in one courtroom down. He was wearing a suit, but he looked more cop than lawyer.
Ballard looked casually back at Carr.
There's somebody watching us, she said.
Black, male, stocky, brown suit, across the hall and down one.
Relax, Carr said. That's Quick, my partner.
You brought your partner?
You're a wild card, Ballard. I wanted to make sure things were cool.
Was he there yesterday when we had our dinner date, too?
He was nearby, yeah.
Ballard looked back over at Carr's partner.
He doesn't look that quick to me, she said.
Carr laughed.
His name is Quentin Kennedy, he said. We call him Quick.
Ballard nodded.
So look, Carr said. I'm taking all of this under advisement, okay? I'm going to go back and talk to my lieutenant and finesse out the thing about Robison's phone. I'll find out how we know you called him. If it's there like you think, I'll get back to you, and then we'll have to talk about the next step, where we take it.
We take it to the DA, Ballard said. We take it to JCID.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves here. We need a lot more than knowledge about your phone calls. There still could be a reasonable explanation.
You keep thinking that, Carr, and keep Quick on your six. You don't want to end up like my former partner.
Ballard stood up again. Without another word, she walked off toward the elevator alcove. She threw a mock salute toward Quick, and he squinted his eyes at her as though he didn't know who she was. But it was too late for that. Chapter 24. Ballard got good and bad news when she arrived at the acute care nursing station on the third floor at County USC. The good news came when she was informed that Ramona Ramon was conscious and alert, and that she had been upgraded to fair condition. The bad news was that she was still intubated, unable to talk, and through hand signals appeared not to know why she was hospitalized or what had happened to her. Ballard was allowed to visit, and as she entered the room, Ramona opened her still swollen eyes a sliver, and they looked at each other for the first time.
Something about seeing this victim awake and coming to understand her dire circumstances was gut-wrenching. There was utter fear in her eyes, fear of the unknown. "Ramona," Ballard began, "I'm Renee. I'm a detective with the Los Angeles Police Department, and I'm going to find the man who did this to you." Ballard put the file she was carrying down on the side table and stood at the side of the bed. Ramona's eyes were nervous and moving rapidly. Her face was still heavily swollen on the right, giving it an asymmetrical shape. Ballard reached over and held her hand, putting her thumb into her palm. "You're safe now," she said. "Nobody will hurt you anymore. What I want you to do now is squeeze my thumb if you understand what I'm telling you." Ballard waited, and soon she felt the squeeze. "Okay, good. That's good, Ramona. Let's do this. I will ask you yes and no questions, okay? If you answer yes, then you squeeze my thumb one time. If your answer is no, then you squeeze twice, okay?" She waited and got one squeeze. "Good. The nurse told me that you're having trouble remembering what happened to you. Is it a total blank?" "Two squeezes." "So there is some that you remember." "One squeeze." "Okay. Let me tell you what we know, and then we will go from there. Today is Monday. Late Thursday night, you were found in a parking lot on Santa Monica Boulevard near Highland Avenue. It was an anonymous call, and the officers who responded at first thought you were dead. That's how bad you looked to them." Ramona closed her eyes and kept them shut. Ballard continued. "You were momentarily conscious as the officers waited for a rescue ambulance. You said something about an upside-down house, and then you lost consciousness. That was all we had to go on. Since then, I've been to the RV where you've lived, and the people there said you had been gone for 5 days. I think someone held you all that time, Ramona, and he hurt you very badly." Ballard saw a tear form in the corner of one of Ramona's eyes. She blinked it away and then looked at Ballard. It was time to start asking questions. "Ramona, do you remember the upside-down house?" "Two squeezes." "Okay. What about the man who hurt you? Do you remember him?" Ballard waited, but there was no reaction from Ramona. "Does that mean it's kind of fuzzy?" "One squeeze." "Okay, that's all right. That's fine. Let's start with some basics then. Do you remember what race the man was?" "One squeeze." Ballard had to be careful not to lead her. A defense attorney could tear her apart on the stand for any false move. "Okay. I'm going to go through some choices, and you keep squeezing once or twice, depending on your answer. Okay?" "One squeeze." "Was he Hispanic?" "Two squeezes." "Okay. How about African American?" "Two squeezes." "Was he a white man?" "One long squeeze." "Okay. He was a white man. Thank you. Let's try to work on a description. Did he have any physical aspect that stood out?" "Two squeezes." "Did he wear glasses?" "Two squeezes." "Did he have a mustache or a beard?" "Two squeezes." "Was he tall?" "One squeeze." "Over 6 feet?" Ramona shook her hand, adding a third signal to the conversation. "Does that mean you're not sure?" "One squeeze." "Okay, got it. Good. You shake your hand like that whenever you're not sure. I have some photos here that I would like to show you. It's called a photo lineup, and I want to see if one of these men looks like the man who hurt you. Is it all right to show you?" "One squeeze." "I'm going to show you 6 at once, and you take your time and look, and then I'll ask you if you recognize any of the photos, okay?" "One squeeze." Ballard let go of Ramona's hand and turned to the side table to pick up the file. She folded the cover back. 6 mugshots were displayed in 6 individual windows, cut into a second file. Beneath each photo was a number. She held it over the bed and a foot from Ramona's eyes. She watched as the victim's eyes moved across the photos, fear and apprehension clear in them. Ballard held the file without speaking for almost a minute. "Okay," she said. She put her thumb back into Ramona's palm. "Do any of the men in the photo lineup look like the man who hurt you, Ramona?" Ballard waited, and finally Ramona shook her hand. "You're not sure." "One squeeze." "Okay, Let's just go through them. Does the man in the photo marked number one look like the man who hurt you? Two squeezes.